Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business. And now, here's your host.
Right, if you could all take our seats, please, and lock them in. Right, we're now going to enter the panel discussion. We asked you to put questions down if you had any. Of course, we did make the big mistake of asking you to write them in pen. The same with the email addresses. If you want them sending, if you could check your email addresses when you come out of the back, because this is one of the reasons we want to get rid of free text message boxes and anything digital, because we can't read them. First thing we're going to do is just run through the panel and the microphone, just for people to introduce themselves, and then we'll start going through the questions.
Sarah Hurley. Janet Clark.
Eric Rooney.
Mick Armstrong, practicing GDP and chair of the BDA.
Janet Williamson from the CQC and chair of the Regulation of Dental Services Programme Board.
Nicholas Taylor, chair of COPDEND and English Dental Deans.
Hello, Miss Campbell, Department of Health, Dental Policy.
Sandra White, I'm the National Lead for Dental Public Health in Public Health England.
David Geddes, I'm the Director of Primary Care Commissioning in NHS England.
Jonathan Green, Executive Director, overseeing fitness practice at the GDC.
Ash Patel, Clinical Lead, Office of the Chief Dental Officer.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. The first question that actually came in is looking at contract reform. Surprise, surprise. Just bearing in mind that we are still in an element of purdah at the moment. So the theme was the timetable for contract reform. Helen, would you like to answer that one?
Yes, of course. Yeah, happy to answer that. We are kind of still in purdah because although Secretary of State has been reappointed, as I think hopefully everybody realises, his team isn't in place and we haven't had absolute confirmation. However, contract reform was name-checked in the manifesto as part of dental policy. So we are making the assumption, and I say that with the caveat that we haven't had absolute confirmation, that we will be proceeding to the timetable Eric outlined earlier, which is we are prototyping currently. There will be a substantive evaluation in the autumn. And on the basis of that evaluation, Department of Health, NHSE, will be taking a decision on how it should be rolled out and the pace of any rollout. So I should dampen down expectations now. That does not mean some kind of massive rollout from April 18. Far from it. We're going to take this at a pace that is consistent with making sure we don't make a complete mistake, like if we're all honest, was made perhaps in 2006 in the way the contract was then rolled out.
Okay, thank you, Rosalie. And it's just, David, do you have any other comments to make at all?
No.
If you pass the microphone back to David, because next one, can NHS England reveal any details to the audience regarding the Starting Well initiative that's due to be launched this September?
I suppose the question came in before we had Sarah talking this morning a bit more about Starting Well, so I'm not too sure if there's a specific question behind here. One of the challenges that you'll be aware of, and Helen's just alluded to, is purdah's got into the way of some of the kind of discussions and the announcements, and this is also one of the areas there. When it was first announced, there was 10 sites which are going to be piloted to look at Starting Well and how we might be able to promote this going forward so we can properly and actively get more care for patients who are particularly the young under 2-year-olds. We looked at the sites which were most likely to benefit, particularly looking at the local authorities where there were greater numbers of health inequalities in this age group. And then actually there were sort of 13 sites which were all quite closely clustered at the top end. So we will be launching this in 13 sites rather than 10. But I can't at the moment say where those sites are. That'll be subject to an announcement probably quite soon, but it needs to be sort of going through ministerial processes as well. Can I ask, I don't know who asked the question, is there anything specifically that hasn't been picked up from Sarah's presentation this morning and from that sort of brief overview, whether there's anything else which is particularly one question, I suppose, behind this overarching question? Or is that answered enough? As much as we can.
That's it. Well, they can't remember they asked the question.
Can I just make a point relating to the first question? I'm really glad that Helen said we're not, for once, not actually rushing to a new contract, because I'd like to think we'd still got a bit of time to influence that. Sarah said that we need a new contract for patients, and we absolutely agree with that. But surely we need one that works for dentists too. And the business model, if that business model doesn't work, then I think getting the profession to buy into that is going to be extremely difficult. And Eric also said that moving to a full capitation model was too radical. I'm not sure who that's too radical for, because in 2005 it worked pretty well. So is it too radical for the Treasury? I guess so. But a lot of the initiatives coming from the LDNs are going to take time. And it's that quality, cost, quantity that we need to square. If you want excellent quality, good outcomes for patients, something's got to give.
Helen, do you want to come back on that at all?
Yeah, happy to, just briefly. I mean, really to offer a bit of just to offer a bit of reassurance, really. I mean, unless the government has changed its views radically, there has been and is no appetite to impose a contract on the profession. Or indeed on the NHS, it's a given that this has to be better for patients, for commissioners and for dentists before we would go for a rollout. And that's why it's taken a long time, being completely honest.
Okay, moving on then to next question on regulation, on the panel considering the regulation profession could best reflect the most appropriate balance between high standards of patient care and the need for efficient delivery model. James? Jonathan, sorry.
Thank you very much. You can call me James.
I can't read my handwriting either.
Having worked in other regulatory sectors, I can actually say my experience over the last 3 years trying to unpick regulation, dental regulation is extremely complicated. The GDC's role in all of this is obviously looking at the individual. And as I think we've just made very clear in our Shifting the Balance document, the GDC sees its role really as promoting positive behaviours and trying to discourage the negative behaviours. And the main vehicle for doing that will be upstreaming the learning from our fitness to practice process as to what good is and what bad is and really working with the profession to highlight those risk areas. The other obviously complicating factor in regulation as well is the sort of systems regulation, the more formal bit. There's been some really, really good work. I know Janet touched on it in her presentation with the RDSPB. And as part of that budding off or blobbing off, seems to be the new word, there's a risk and oversight group that has arisen from that, which is basically, it's very operational. Members from a number of organisations really looking at what's going on at the coalface in terms of the main drivers of fitness of practice referrals at the moment. We've had one meeting. It's very, very, very productive. And I think that will really help in part of that upstreaming work. I think the other thing that I'll mention as well is that although there's been really good stuff going on at the GDC, the CQC, NHS and other organisations, one of the things that needs to be addressed in terms of regulation is those things that those organisations struggle to deal with. And that's the sort of drivers of behaviour. The NHS contract is one. When I sit in and observe fitness of practice hearings, it very often part of a registrant's defence is that their record keeping struggled because they were up against it in terms of time. We and our panels are sympathetic to that, but obviously it's something that needs to be addressed as part of the regulatory picture.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Is it any further question anybody wants to ask on that at all? Excellent. Moving on then to training and the strategy and planning to ensure sufficient depth and breadth of workforce skill sets. Nicholas.
Well, as I said, I'm from Health Education England, and my mandate really is to provide the right workforce for NHS England with the right skills, abilities, and values. The problem is that we are under a period of purdah, and there's a number of things going on in the background, but essentially the mandate for this year hasn't been approved, and neither has the investment plan, but we're working very closely with the Office of the CDO to take that forward. Our five work streams at the moment really are obviously foundation training when they qualify, followed by dental core training for a slightly smaller number, and for a very small number we take into specialty training. After that, it's the workforce transformation development to keep the workforce up to speed with the changes in technology, the requirements of the service, etc., that happen. We have taken a step back from the review of the curriculum from the specials at the moment because it came really through a number of meetings that the specialties weren't fitting exactly what the service need requires. So we've pressed the pause button on that. And in a meeting with the GDC talking about quality assurance and the way forward, we've started to kind of say, okay, we've got the 13 specialties. We're going to review where we are with it, along with all the CDOs from around the country, to see that we've got the right people to service the needs. On top of that, we've had also the work we do with DCPs. Not every HE office has a role with the development of therapists and hygienists, but certainly in large areas of the country, the therapists that we have trained are not fulfilling the role that we trained them for, and that's a lot to do, again, contract reform and the way things are developing. And we've got to kind of look ahead now to see what contract reform might look like and develop perhaps more therapists to fulfill the roles that that new contract will look like if it reflects in any way what the Steele report was of 2009. So there's lots of things going on in training and development. We're having a big review of where we are, and hopefully that will kind of get a good kickstart in the next few weeks to take matters on.
Okay, if you'd like to keep the microphone, because the next one's for you as well, is the educational framework for the DCPs.
I think it's very much the same issue, really. I don't think you can look at DCPs in isolation from the rest of the workforce. As you know, the bursaries were taken away from us, out of HEE, and they've moved into apprenticeships, perhaps, or the it may be different routes into dentistry, that you kind of come into dentistry as a well, not knowing quite your exit point. So you won't come in as a dentist, you might exit as being a therapist. There's lots of other ideas being bandied about now as ways of taking the workforce forward to get the right people in the right place.
Okay. So, Sandra, do you have any comments at all? Nope. Right. Moving on then to employment of the workforce and how do we encourage GDPs to employ a broader skill mix within the dental practice workforce. And I'll ask Mick to lead on this one.
I think broadly we engage quite well with the team approach. It is limited though, because why are we still hitting targets when we could do so much better with our workforce if we didn't have to hit targets? And there's a significant lack of capital investment as well. I think a lot of practices could expand physically and have more surgeries where you could have dedicated DCPs and preventative units, but we are limited by what we can provide from our estate. So we are the forgotten part of the NHS. GPs get extensive grants, premises, etc., and we don't. And simply, there is not enough money in the current contract to allow us to provide the excellence that we can do.
Nicholas?
I think it does depend on what contract reform looks like. I would like to think that we can improve this skill mix of practice so that people are doing things that they're actually directly trained for and not limiting their skills or doing above their kind of their remit. So we're working very closely, as you know, with the Office of the CDO and the Department of Health to try and kind of almost preempt the workforce that we need so we can start training now for a contract that is brought in a few years' time.
Okay, and David, do you have any comments on that at all?
I think, I mean, just to, I suppose, add from a commissioning perspective, we're aware, we're just having some discussions earlier regarding the variability in accessing dentists and the challenges in the workforce, particularly in some recruitment areas. So we need to become a little bit more upstream in terms of our approach to help support some areas where there are fewer dentists now being able to be recruited. So we know there are sort of hot spots in the across the country, and we need to be working with Health Education England and yourselves in order to be able to understand how we might be able to incentivize some individuals to work there. That's something we need to be sort of putting our thinking hats on in terms of being able to, I suppose, to see how we might be able to look at how we can lever, like we have in some GPs, different workforce in different parts of the country.
Okay, thank you. And Eric, have you got?
Yeah, just to say that in terms of the contract, in the piloting phase, I alluded before to a couple of reports, evaluation reports that were done, and 87% of the practices in the pilot phase when asked the question, if this was the model, that is the clinical model that I showed you before, which obviously is heavily focused on prevention and the potential for other and assessment, potential for other people in the dental team to do elements of that pathway, 87% of them said, if we knew that that was definitely the direction of travel, then we would change our skill mix. So that's the kind of, I'm a believer that whatever the product is that we, you know, we all agree is what needs to be delivered, and the kind of commercial aspects around that, that's what will drive whether skill mix is used or not.
And Janet, you got a comment as well?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think when I was making my presentation, I was talking about extension of medicine's mechanisms to dental hygienists and therapists, and a lot of stakeholder engagement that will be needed as part of that process. And I think we can use that stakeholder engagement to raise the profile of dental hygienists and therapists, because, as I said, I don't actually think a lot of dentists really quite understand how valuable they can be. And I don't think the public know who they are either. So I'm hoping that we can actually, you know, get a bit of a byproduct really from that piece of work.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Acutely aware of the political bits and pieces around this one, but the supply of dentists from the European Union in the post Brexit era. Helen, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think obviously it's a very topical question. Obviously, it goes much, much wider than dentistry. It goes right across the NHS. There is a dedicated team within DH and Meridian NHS England focusing solely on post-Brexit workforce issues. So while I can't give specific reassurances about dentists, what I can say is it's being looked at really closely. And the one thing I would say is that before we had free movement, there still were quite substantial numbers of dentists recruited from overseas periodically.
And Jonathan?
I think just to echo, I suppose, what Helen just said, I mean, we are working very, very excited on this as an issue. Obviously, the workforce coming from Europe is significant, but also too is the workforce coming from other parts of the world. So we need to recognise the challenges. Obviously, the new government will need to consider some of these issues as we go forward. And we need to be able to identify a range of issues that are obviously very pertinent to the world of dentistry and to primary care, full stop. So actually, there is a significant team now, which Simon Stevens has asked to be developed specifically to look at this area. So we make sure that whilst the Secretary of State for Health isn't around the table regarding Brexit discussions, he is particularly well cited on the issues that are affecting the NHS and how we need to be able to address those.
The GDC is conducting a very close watching brief on this. 17% of the register made up of European qualified dentists, 1% European qualified DCPs. So there's obviously a significant risk factor there. We haven't noticed any drop-off since the referendum in the number of registrations. Like some of the regulators, just to share a piece of GMC intelligence, they contacted and surveyed 2,000 European qualified medics last year, and 60% of that 2,000 said that they were considering leaving the UK, and 90% of them explained that that was due to Brexit. So there's clearly a big risk there. We're conducting, as I said, a very close watching brief. Members of the executive team and council are obviously negotiating and talking to Department of Health officials to make sure that they're alive to the risk.
And I think the BDA would support that view as well, and try and look after interests of its members wherever they came from.
I think this question relates to the one about the employment of DCPs, because we know that there are large numbers of hygienists and therapists in this country looking for more employment, and wherefore it may be the fact that the numbers of dentists available, but the work, which is actually well within the competencies and skill sets of therapists and hygienists, it may be, again, a paradigm shift in the employment model of a practice. And it may be that you don't look overseas, you actually look at the UK graduate and you look at the UK DCP graduate that offers you the opportunity to run a quality service from your practice.
Thank you, Sarah. A rip as opposed to a ripple. And the elephant in the room, funding. How confident is the panel that over the next 10 years, the share of the NHS budget devoted to dentistry will not be diminished. David.
I think, first of all, we need to highlight there isn't actually a budget devoted to dentistry. So it isn't that there is a pot of money which sits in the system for dentistry as opposed to pharmacy, as opposed to medicine or any other part of the sector. So we need to, I suppose, dispel that myth that there is a ring-fenced budget for anything. I guess what we are seeing in the commissioning of care across NHS England or the NHS in England is a shift towards more localised commissioning. And that means that there is a shift, a significant shift, to those STP areas, those sustainability and transformation planning areas. There are 44 of those. So this is a new sort of footprint, which we haven't really talked about so far today. But I think that's a really important footprint because that's where you're going to start moving towards blurring more of the boundary between commissioners and providers. So when we're talking about a budget, we need to recognise that actually the budget, as we sometimes refer to it, is probably a little bit more in the old world of thinking you've got commissioners here and you've got providers, and the commissioners say, this is what we want, and the providers give it for X amount of money. And I think that's changing. I don't know how fast or how quickly it'll happen or where we'll see it first. But certainly in places like Manchester, there is increasingly a move away from that rather binary split between commissioning and providing, and instead a move towards something which is more towards accountable care systems, where providers and commissioners, and particularly providers actually, move together to work collaboratively about how they can best deliver the care they need to for the population. And that puts a really significant onus on people like Sandra, who needs to be able to, I suppose, highlight what the dental needs are for that area, for that new area, and how, as a provider network, we are better able to deliver that care in the most appropriate setting. So we know there is a significant amount of work going on still in secondary care. We know that actually a lot of that work doesn't need to be delivered in secondary care. From a purely commissioning point of view, it would make an awful lot of sense to shift that economically to get more for your money and could deliver that care in the community, which is a huge bonus for patients because they don't have to travel so far and they don't have to park their car so expensively. So the big benefits, if we think about it, from what do we need at a local kind of footprint, like a STP footprint. And I think actually the terminology of commissioning budgets is probably something that over the next few years we'll see becomes not consigned necessarily to the history book, but seen very differently through a different lens when we think about things from a provider and a commissioner network, which is working together in an accountable care system or moving towards an accountable care organisation.
Sandra, do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I was actually going to talk about something slightly different but related, which is around, I'm sure the question was around the funding of dental services. But of course, the responsibility for oral health improvement as of 2013 went to local authorities. And there is money at the moment in what was ring-fenced in local authority budgets for water fluoridation, for fluoride varnish schemes, for toothbrushing schemes in schools. All of the things, some of the things that Childsmile does in Scotland is carried out by lots of the local authorities in England using their local authority budgets. And actually, that's you know, we know that prevention is better than cure. We know that if there's a little amount of money, it's, you know, some of it, you know, a lot of it should be spent on prevention. And so actually, that, you know, we all have concerns about how we get the best bang for the buck. And certainly, we've got a return on investment tool that came out in terms of if you spend £1 on fluoride varnish scheme locally, what's the return to the local authority? And it's really important that local dental networks, and especially in those places where there's devolution, like Manchester, and there's a sort of a blurred health and social care budget, that actually, you know, that's really focused on. So, and I go back to, yes, the needs as well. You've really got to make sure, if you've only got a little bit of money, that you make sure you focus it on those that need it most.
Thank you. Mick?
Yeah, it's become increasingly transparent over the last few years that the dental budget isn't protected. But I'm glad to hear it's flexible, because that means it might go back up a bit. I think what the NHS needs to decide, though, I mean, and I note the Smile for Life campaign, it's not actually Chew for Life, is it? It's got sort of an aesthetic aspect to it. And increasingly, our patients demand excellent aesthetics as well as function, and they want it for a long time. So should the NHS be paying for that? all of it or some of it. And I think a bit of clarity about what the NHS dentistry is going to offer would be very welcome throughout the profession.
Helen, you got comments on that?
Not particularly on that last point, but just to come back to the budget issue, I'll just echo what David said. It's really important to reiterate there isn't a dental budget. What there is a legal regulatory duty to commission services to meet need. Now, it's really interesting your point that there's this whole other area in local authorities about improving oral health, but as a boring civil servant, the boring basic duty is to ensure that everyone, as far as possible, can get access to primary care dentistry when they need it. Now, I think it's improved massively over the last 10 years. There are still areas where it is difficult. There are other areas where it's now probably just about okay, but that's the duty. Now, priorities may change and differ, so the amount of spend may change, but the duty never goes away. It's written into law.
Eric.
Yeah, I think what David's saying about the wider landscape, and it was in that kind of big diagram I put up there before, the issue is that the money will, I think, ultimately, this is a personal view, be locally controlled. And I think as a profession, if you like, we need to seriously think about our place in that whole range of primary and some of the what was historically secondary care that is moving out into the, call it the community setting. Because I think that's where the money will be. And we have things to offer in terms of, and I kind of mentioned this in what I said, our contribution to the wider general health of the population and the rest of that group, so the GPs, health visitors, district nurses, all those kinds of people have stuff to offer in terms of helping us to improve the oral health of our local population. So I think we really need to think over this next couple of years, as all of this develops, how we perhaps integrate a bit more than perhaps we have done in the past. And one of the vehicles, I think, for that is our LDN infrastructure that we have in NHS England, with its professional input of local dentists who can start to play in the same arena, if you like, where the money is, with GPs and the rest of the local healthcare system, and potentially have some access to some of the resources that are going into the development of that. And the kinds of things that the LDNs I was showing you have been working on, for example, dementia. That is a big problem for lots of our CCGs and the accountable care organisations as they develop. They've got a population who's getting older, who's got long-term conditions. And as Sarah has said on many occasions, every patient has a mouth. And therefore, in terms of our services, not just being perhaps the historic services where we were perhaps isolated and we waited for people to come to us, a degree of integration, I think, is where the NHS money will be.
And of course, the most important voice in all this is the patient's voice. We've talked about, you know, an NHS England, a DH, a BDA, and the profession's ambition. But what does the patient want? And they are clearly the biggest stakeholder. They've got more to lose, but they've also got more to win. Whether it be the aesthetic value of a smile or actually maintaining function and feeling good about themselves. So we do need to make sure that everything we do puts the patient first. And within NHS England, the commissioning, clearly that whole patient public voice is integral into the way they operate. But more importantly, I think I don't know if she's here, I'm looking across the room, we have a patient rep today who sits on the primary care oversight group and again has spent some time with myself and Janet. And will continue because actually the patient voice at the strategic level is as valuable as it is at the local level.
The next slide, which you put up there, there wasn't one single question asked about the patient. There has been one written up on this one, and it's to do with the digital bit. What is the plan for patient access to Snowdent? Under the Health and Social Care Act and the acts that have come out, I think from 1st of April last year, 2015, patients were allowed access to their records. And that applies equally to the dental practice in actually going in there and looking at the records. Of course, what you can't do is look at them online at the moment because each dental practice is its own independent business and therefore it keeps those records to itself. That's one of the reasons for the Snowdent piece, is for us actually to be able to see some of that data coming back, especially on the diagnosis side. So the patients will actually have access onto that. There were some other questions on the digital side, mostly to do with funding and who actually does it. And as I've just mentioned, each dental practice is an independent business which goes through, works out its business plan to meet the contract that it's actually going to go and bid for. So on the digital side, what we're actually talking about is having a dental practice system, it actually within the dental practice, which is able to access the health and social care network in order that NHS can then provide the e-referral system, the e-prescribing, and the patient care summary, which actually goes on that. Okay. Those are the questions that actually came in. Thank you much indeed to the panel, and I'll call upon Sara now to conclude them.
So I did a quick vox pops during coffee from various individuals about the value of today. We would obviously clearly value your feedback, and it's the citizen survey, am I right in thinking we're going to be using afterwards? So feedback on what's been valuable, what's not, because we want to learn from both what is good and not what is not quite so good. We're hoping that you're going to be able to use a little bit of the time afterwards. You're free to visit the rest of the museum, but actually if you want to use it as a bit more of a networking opportunity, please do. I'd like to thank first and foremost the panel, the wide-ranging questions that were put up. I think what it drives home is that to deliver what we want to be able to do is not about the office of CDO. It's not about a personality or an individual. It is about a team of individuals that actually many of the levers sit in their hands, whether it be the BDA, NHS England, Public Health England, DH or HE. But what we have got, and I really do feel very confident going forward, is that we have a coalition of the willing, if I'm going to hark back to a political phrase used before. But the coalition of the willing will all have different demands and priorities from its leadership, and we need to understand that there will be a little bit of compromise along the way. And much that compromise may be in the time scale in order to get something right. And I think Helen aptly put it out earlier on in terms of, you know, we're not going to rush to repeat the same mistakes. We're actually going to move. We're going to learn with each stage. Yes, the contract reform process is something we all have an ambition for, and there are different elements from both the patient, our understanding, what NHS England's looking to derive in terms of demonstrating value for money to a taxpayer, the DH ambition for increasing access, and the PHE ambition for improving oral health alongside all the other things we're doing.